everybody. This morning, during my Dharma talk, first day of session here at Santa Sabina, I forgot to push the button to record the talk, so it wasn't recorded. So this afternoon, after lunch of the same day, I'm going to record my talk. It won't be exactly the same as what I said this morning. It certainly won't be the same feeling. But more or less, I'm going to make the same points. So here we are. So good morning, everyone. It was morning when I gave this talk. It's great to see everyone. Quite spectacular, really, to see so many human beings, marvelous human beings, together in the same physical place, practicing. And also great that we can be joined in this by many, many more who are in other physical places, all of us taking care of one another. It is a fabulous thing, a very moving thing. And I want to thank each and every one of you, including those of you listening now, for having the vision of your human life that makes doing this practice together something that matters to you. And thanks to our Everyday Zen Sangha team, who has worked so hard to bring this about. This in itself is the Buddha way, and I'm grateful to all of you for helping me to practice. Some of you know that in the fall, our road washed out, and there's been a lot of road work going on around our house. Because of that, many reversals and setbacks. Sometimes that results in our having to park our car about a quarter of a mile away from the house because the road is impassable. And that's what happened yesterday. I was doing that when I ran into one of the guys who fixes our septic system. He was fixing the system at one of our neighbors' houses, and I happened to pull up right behind him just as he was getting in his car to leave. I envy those of you who don't have septic systems and who can rely on the city or the county or whoever it is to take care of your sewage system. It's a real blessing. You're lucky. We don't have that blessing. We have our own septic system and leach field and everything, and it often goes on the fritz. We've had lots of memorable, messy episodes. So I really appreciate the people who know how to install and maintain such systems and come and save you when you're in trouble. To me, this is the definition of an awesome Buddha. And I feel that way about our septic guys. Anyway, he came and said hi to me. He also happens to be an experienced Zen student of many decades. And he said to me, well, I had a surprise recently when I was in Sesshin, and I started having the weirdest experiences, all kinds of funny experiences in my body, and I was scared. I was maybe losing my mind, and I felt badly about it, because in Zen you are not supposed to get involved in special meditation experiences. So I was, on top of everything else, a little embarrassed. Maybe I was doing the wrong thing. So I asked my teachers about it, but they didn't have much to say. And it turned out when I asked John, who's another one of our neighbors, who is also a Dharma student of long standing, John told me that I was probably experiencing the jhanic states, and he gave me some stuff to read about it, and yeah, it sounded like what was happening. Well, it is true that in Zen practice, we are just sitting, and we're not trying to experience spectacular meditation states. But even so, sometimes we might be surprised and maybe even startled by what happens. So in honor of my friend who fixes our septic system, I thought I would begin on this first day of our session to talk about the eight jhanas, even though usually we don't talk about them, and maybe it's not even such a good idea to talk about them, because meditation states are not the main point. The main point is to live an awakened life. Still, sometimes in Sesshin we might find ourselves spontaneously practicing the jhanas, just like my friend. In order to talk about the jhanas, first I have to tell you that in Buddhist discourse we understand that there are three realms: Kama Dhatu, Rupa Dhatu, and Arupa Dhatu. Dhatu means realm, world. Kama Dhatu or Karma Dhatu is the regular world we usually live in, the physical world, with its emotions and desires and problems and so on. We usually lean forward or backward in Kama Dhatu, out of the present moment. So we're always mad about something, or upset about something, or chewing on something maybe that happened a long time ago without knowing we're chewing on it, or longing for something that we don't now have, even though often we have no idea that this is going on. But that's what happens in Kama Dhatu. It's a painful world, a difficult world, and as they say in the Pali texts, a coarse world, C-O-A-R-S-E. And if we're exclusively stuck in this realm, we're going to have a rough time. Rupa Dhatu is the realm of form. It's very much like Plato's idea of the perfect world of ideal forms. So forms, the world of form, Rupa Dhatu, is a kind of idealized world, a refined world, not coarse, beyond coarse desire and the complications of the ordinary world. And in fact, this idea of coarseness and refinement is central to the development of the jhanas. They are a process of continual refinement, each jhana more refined and subtle than the last. Rupa Dhatu, in other words, is the world of meditation practice, the world we live in when, with the help of our breath, we refine our mind and spirit and let go of the roughness, coarseness of Karma Dhatu and allow things to begin to flow pleasantly. And this is one of the pleasures of Sesshin, because even though Sesshin might from time to time be difficult, usually most of us do enter Rupa Dhatu in Sesshin, and it's very, very happy, even joyful experience. Rupa Dhatu is the world of the great Mahayana Sutras that we often read. It's a world full of perfect bodhisattvas, all attractive and young and thin, and beautiful trees, jewel covered, and maybe lapis lazuli ground, and parasols and banners, and beautiful music and beautiful fragrances, the ideal world. Arupa Dhatu is the next world beyond this, even more purified, almost not even there. In fact, it is an immaterial realm by definition. No more body in Arupa Dhatu. So I think that most of us are at least a little familiar with the four Rupa Dhatu jhanas, but less familiar with the four Arupa Dhatu jhanas, which probably don't arise unless we're doing very extreme meditation, maybe a multiple year or certainly multiple month retreat, maybe sitting by ourselves in a cave, maybe sitting down and not getting up from our seat for hours and hours without moving. So we're not so familiar with, you know, doing Sesshin is different from that. But you never know. The four formless Arupa Dhatu jhanas could come up maybe in a flash, suddenly here and gone, or maybe they come up and you didn't notice they did. The word jhana, by the way, is the same word as dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. J-H-A-N-A is the same word as dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A, which is the same word as chan, and the same word as zen, which means more or less meditation, concentrated meditation. So now, with that preliminary, I'm going to read you the description of the eight jhanic states as it is written in the Pali Canon. So the first rupa jhana says this: there is the case where a monastic, quite secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with initial and sustained thinking, and is filled with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. So it takes special conditions to achieve the first jhana. We have to organize good and peaceful conditions, like we have done here in our sesshin. No newspapers, no talking, no controversy. We're not saying anything to one another to make us upset or doubtful. No meals to cook, no chores, no bills to pay, nothing to be responsible for. Everything organized for maximum peacefulness, and to give us the opportunity to match that external peacefulness with our inner cultivation of peacefulness. So we practice breathing. We gently bring the focus back on every moment of our experience, whatever is going on, walking, eating, going to the toilet, cleaning our body. And little by little, our mind becomes concentrated. And we're not putting any pressure on ourselves. We have nothing we really need to do. We just simply make a smooth effort to stay with our breathing and the feeling of our body. And after a little while, usually maybe a brief adjustment period, you will feel a kind of lightness and happiness. You just feel good. Life is effortless. In the first jhana, as it says, you can still have some thoughts in your mind. You can have maybe some insights. You can come to some understanding about your life you didn't have before. Ah, that's what that was about. Now I understand. You can have some insight about Dharma, you know, really come to understand some teachings that you didn't quite understand before. So there's some thinking that goes on in the first jhana, but mostly it's just ease and delight. They call it rapture, which sounds pretty good. When it says secluded from unwholesome states of mind, it means specifically having overcome the five hindrances, which are sensual desire, ill will, laziness or sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt. These are the five classical hindrances of early Buddhist thought. These are the states of mind that prevent meditation. In the first jhana, they are replaced with ease and rapture. The text goes on to supply some metaphors for this first jhana. It says, the practitioner drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses their body with this rapture and happiness, so that there is no part of the entire body, not suffused with rapture and happiness. Just as if a skilled bath attendant or that attendant's apprentice would pour soap powder into a metal basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water so that the ball of soap powder would be filled with moisture, encompassed by moisture, pervaded by moisture inside and out, yet would not drip. I guess that describes the way they made soap in the monasteries in ancient times. Even so, just like that, the monastic drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses their body with the rapture and happiness born of seclusion, so that there's no part of the body not suffused with rapture and happiness. So this is a very physical experience. The lightness of the body, free from kinks. Whatever pain you might have had in your body either goes away magically somehow, or you just don't care about it anymore. You're not longing for it to go away, so it doesn't hurt. Next, as you continue to refine the first jhana, seamlessly develops into the second jhana, which is described like this. Further, the stilling of initial and sustained thinking, two kinds of thinking, but we don't need to define them, basically thinking, the stilling of thinking, by gaining inner tranquility and unification of mind, the practitioner enters and remains now in the second jhana, which is free from initial and sustained thinking and is filled with rapture and happiness born of concentration. So at this point, it's clear, the thinking falls away. You don't think, oh my God, I'm not thinking anymore, because that's thinking. You don't think much of anything, and you don't think you're not thinking. The thinking might pop back all of a sudden because the jhanic states are quite free, you know, and they come, they go. They can be just for a moment. You can pop in and out of these states. So maybe you're in the second jhana and then something happens and then you return to the first. Maybe you go back and forth. But anyway, the characteristic of the second jhana is no thinking. Just sensation, perception, just the sense of being there in life, even though no one is there, strictly speaking, because the sense of yourself being there that you usually have requires some degree of thinking. And of course, we're thinking all the time. That's how we know we're here. I think we're thinking even when we're sleeping. But in the second jhana, we're not thinking. It feels as if the world, which was just kind of lying there before, is somehow a problem for us to deal with. That world comes alive. So there's way more world and way less us. The whole world is alive, and everything and everyone in that world is alive. But this is not exciting. It's rather quiet and matter of fact. Because if it were exciting, there would be thinking again, and then it would all disappear. So here again, there are some metaphors that describe this. Similar metaphors. The practitioner drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses their body with this rapture and happiness so that there's no part of the entire body not suffused with rapture and happiness. It's just like a lake with spring water welling up from below, having no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and with the skies not periodically supplying it with rain so that the cool spring water welling up from below permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills that lake with cool water. No part of the lake is not suffused with cool water. And just like that, the monastic drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses their body with the rapture and happiness born of concentration. There's no part of the body not suffused with that. So the idea is that from each jhana we continue to make effort. We're not trying to, you know, go further, but when we really achieve the state, we begin to notice coarse elements in it, and we just keep paying attention, and then we evolve into the next state, in this case the third jhana, which is described like this. Further, with the fading away of rapture, remaining imperturbable, mindful, and clearly aware, the practitioner enters the third jhana and experiences within himself the joy of which the noble ones declare, happy is the person who dwells with equanimity and mindfulness. And the practitioner drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses the body with this happiness, free from rapture. So there's no part of his body, and so on and so on. Just as in a blue, white, and red lotus pond, there may be some of the lotuses which, born and growing in the water, stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water, so that they are permeated and pervaded and suffused and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips, so that no part of those lotuses is not suffused with cool water. Even so, the monk drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses his body with this happiness free from rapture, so that there is no part of the entire body not suffused with happiness. I know that in our chant we say, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond, on the theory that the lotus pops out of the water and is beyond the water. But here, I guess there are some lotus flowers that do that, and others that stay close to the surface, to the leaves that float on the surface. I guess that's what this metaphor is talking about. Anyway, you notice that in this jhana, there's no rapture. Rapture goes away. It seems like that's too bad. But when you practice the second jhana, after a while, you realize that there's a little something jangly in rapture. There's a little bit of grabbiness there. You like it a little too much. And after a while, that becomes a problem. And just like thinking smooths out and falls away in the previous jhana, so here the joy smooths out and falls away, because actually the joy had some issues with it. It was a little bit more than it needed to be, so it falls away, and instead of it you have awareness, you have equanimity and mindfulness, imperturbability. Equanimity means that everything can be received equally with some happiness, but without any excitement. And you're more or less paying attention all the time, not intentionally, but your body is just doing this. So that even if you think you're goofing off, you're still doing this, you're still there, and life is flowing along. The practice is happening where you are. You're not doing the practice in a way, it's doing you. And that's the third jhana. And the fourth is more or less the same as this. It's just a further refinement and intensification. And here is what it says about the fourth. Further, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, as with the earlier disappearance of joy and sorrow, he enters and remains in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain, and purified by equanimity and mindfulness. He or she or they sit, suffusing their body with a pure, bright awareness. So there's nothing of the body not suffused with pure, bright awareness. And then they give the metaphor of a man wrapped from head to foot with a white cloth, cloth, pure white cloth. So here in the fourth jhana, the emphasis is on everything falling away but awareness itself. Just awareness, not your awareness, but awareness itself. And that's the hallmark of the fourth jhana. Very, very simple. So this is followed by the four arupa jhanas, which are, in all the texts, described very briefly. So they're a little mysterious and vague, and not much commentary is given about them. Most important point is they are immaterial. You stop feeling like you are embodied. You disappear. You know, you're not there anymore. There's just some sort of immaterial consciousness. And this, you could imagine, could be a little scary. Maybe this is what my friend was noticing and it was upsetting to him. So if this should happen to you during this session, you disappear and it's a little spooky, and don't worry, this never happens. But just in case it does, don't be alarmed and immediately let somebody know. One of the Enos or the senior practitioners know. Maybe not somebody who you don't know, who just got here and just beginning their practice. That might be unstable for them too. But let one of the people who appear to be somebody who's been around for a while, just take them aside and tell them about it. Usually just telling them will help quite a bit. And I can't repeat enough times that we're not hoping for this. We're not aiming for this. Anyway, these four formless jhanas are also in a progression of, you know, more coarse to more subtle. They start with space, which is external. Then consciousness, which is really neither external nor internal. To nothingness or voidness, which isn't anything. And then finally, to what's called mysteriously neither perception nor non-perception, where you are not sure. You can't even say, you know, is anything going on or not. This is somehow beyond consciousness, although I sometimes have that feeling, not when I'm meditating, but at any time, I could wonder, as I often do, am I really here or not? And is anything that I think is going on actually going on or not? But when I have that thought, I'm still a human being having that thought. In Rupa Dhatu, you have almost gone beyond being human. And here are the descriptions of the four arupa jhanas. With the complete transcending of bodily sensations, with the disappearance of all sense of resistance and not heeding perceptions of diversity, thinking, space is infinite. One enters and remains in the sphere of infinite space. That's the first one. With the complete transcending of the sphere of infinite space, thinking consciousness is infinite, one enters and remains in the sphere of infinite consciousness. With the complete transcending of the sphere of infinite consciousness, thinking there is nothing, no thing, one enters and remains in the sphere of no thingness, nothingness. That's the third of the four. And the last, with the complete transcending of the sphere of no thingness, one enters and remains in the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. And those are from those descriptions are from the Digha Nikaya Sutta 15. Maybe you notice that in the beginning of this progression of four, and throughout, there seems oddly to be thinking again. In the first of the four, diversity is left behind. Diversity meaning the distinguishing of anything from anything else, which is what we call perception. But thinking depends on being embodied, depends on perception of diversity. So when it says thinking here, it's not the usual kind of thinking. In this kind of thinking, in a way, there's only the thinking, which is then becomes space or consciousness or whatever it is. I'm not thinking about something. Anyway, I think it's counterproductive to go into all this too far. It becomes, you know, really interesting and a distraction. And if you're a meditation person, you might think it would be great to experience such things. So then that's a problem for you. And it gets, you know, very conceptual, and maybe it messes up our practice, so please forget everything I said about all that. I think it'll be easy to forget. There's a lot of controversy, actually, about the eight jhanas. They were definitely not something the Buddha invented. They were a pre-existing part of the amazing perennial tradition of Indian meditation. In most accounts of the Buddha's awakening that I am aware of in the early suttas, they say that the Buddha practiced maybe the first two or maybe the first four of the jhanas. And I forget which jhana he was in when he leapt off and entered awakening, maybe the second. Once, notoriously, Thich Nhat Hanh argued that the jhanas are not at all necessary and they're not really a part of Buddhism. He did some scholarly argumentation about that, and I think a lot of people who love the jhanas and teach them didn't like that. Anyway, it seems clear that awakening does not require the practice of the eight jhanic states. There are many Western gurus who have had awakening experiences without any meditation practice at all, just spontaneously, out of their tremendous suffering, they had a transcendent experience. And I think it's actually kind of common that there are awakening experiences without meditation practice. My thought is that a lot of children have these experiences, but there's no language for them and no one to talk to about them. And as they grow up and develop more of a sense of self, it's not relevant. So you forget about them. Probably you had awakening experiences when you were a child that you forgot about. So why practice meditation? The reason in Buddhism that a certain amount of discipline meditation practice is recommended is because we are not trying to produce an awakening experience, we are trying to live an awakened life. And just like in the metaphors that describe the jhanic states, we are trying to suffuse our lives through and through with awakening, so that our thinking and our feeling and our body and our conduct and our emotions are all suffused with awakening. To practice like that probably requires some disciplined meditation practice over time, including practicing together in relationship, which makes a big difference, and some Dharma study and understanding and so on, all the things that we do in practice. So that awakening can be something we live all the time rather than a powerful enthusiasm. And in Sesshin, specifically, our job is just to pay attention the best we can and flow with the schedule and the arrangements. Maybe when you first arrived, you were a little worried about how this was going to go, especially if you came from far away and aren't used to practicing with everyday Zen or even Zen practice. I think a few of you are possibly new to Zen practice. Maybe you were worried about yourself, which is, of course, quite normal. We all worry about ourselves. But pretty soon you stop worrying because you settle down. You don't want anything or need anything. You are happy to get up when the bell rings, sit when it's time to sit, walk when it's time to walk, eat when it's time to eat. My friend John O'Grady, who is a Zen student from Rip Van Winkle country, out in the Catskills there, and John often attends our events online, so we see him. He was in the Bay Area recently for a while. He writes in his book that the sire part of the word desire comes etymologically from the word for star. You can see that, right? Distant. To desire is by definition to be reaching for something at some distance. And like a star, something at some distance that glitters and is especially wonderful since it's so far away. And usually, when there's desire, we're focused on the object of desire, way, way over there. And that's why longing, he says, is a synonym for desire. Longing for something. Long, long away. Far, far away. And in a way, this is kind of exciting, meaning it has lots of thought and emotion in it. But also, it's inherently uncomfortable. Sense desire is the first of the five hindrances, but really the hindrance, I would say, includes all kinds of desire. Desire arises naturally, so you're not able to make it go away. You can't erase it. Desire really is life. But when you focus your heart on the desire itself, which is right here, rather than the object of the desire, which is so painfully not right here, but over there somewhere, then desire is fine. It's evidence that you're a human being, that you're alive, which is a precious and wonderful thing. So that's what we do in Sesshin, quite spontaneously. It just happens. Our desire and our worry fall away. Trying to make something happen is desire, right? To want this that is not here to manifest. I would like to meditate better. I would like to experience the jhanic states and so on. So we don't bother with that. I think we can see through that quite easily. And we just do the practice. And everything unfolds as it will. You never know quite how it will unfold, but usually it works out okay. But I think the main experience of sense desire in Sesshin is aversion, which is the backside of desire. Still desire, but the other side of it. To love and to hate are opposites, but we can see that they're very much the same thing. Ask any experienced divorce attorney. Anyway, in Sesshin there's something about aversion that is very compelling. Sometimes we're averse to the schedule, especially in the beginning. Sometimes we have a lot of aversive feelings about the bell or the bell ringer who seems to refuse to ring the bell when it's time, when we need it to ring. Sometimes it's the other practitioners who are very annoying in a variety of ways, especially the leaders and teachers who can really piss you off. But mostly it's the painful sensations in your own body, which you would like to go away, but the more you want them to go away, the less they do. So just as we were saying a moment ago about desire, it's the same. When aversion arises, don't let it grab you. Don't focus on the object. See how painful aversion is. And switch your attention from the object of your aversion, that you want the pain to go away, that you want the bell to ring, and pay attention to the aversion itself. Let your breath support you in this. Breathe strongly, deliberately. Be fierce in breathing. And you do this not to cover over the aversion or make it go away, but to be able to sustain it. And it won't take long before the aversion passes and things change. Things do change. Of this we can be absolutely sure, for better and worse, depending on your point of view. Things change. Everything bad will eventually be good, and everything good will eventually come to an end. And this is why equanimity is such a basic practice. With equanimity, there's no more good or bad, there's just what happens. So in session, I like to emphasize the breath, and maybe some of you have some other way to practice, and that's okay. And I know that some people have conditions that make it difficult to breathe. But I like to practice with the breath. It's always been my favorite, most powerful practice for me. And it is a fundamental Dharma practice. There's even a sutra about breathing. It's a really good practice. Since my rabbi is sitting here in the room right in front of me, I will also mention that in the Bible, in the Torah, when God creates human beings, God does it by breathing a breath into us. That's how we come alive. Made B'Tselem Elohim, like it says, in the image of God, by the breath. And we know that's true, don't we? Breath is life. Life is sacred. So we practice breathing smoothly and naturally through the nostrils, paying attention to every breath and feeling the breath suffusing the body. And the breathing happens throughout the body. Feel the breathing, especially in your belly, low down in your belly. This place low in the belly connects your body to the earth, because the body actually is the earth. There's nothing in the body that is not from the earth, of the earth, and when the body doesn't need you anymore, it will return to the earth. So when you breathe in your belly, you feel this profound connection. And as you breathe, you go beyond yourself, which means you really become yourself. And it's not a matter of trying to breathe in some special way. It's just a matter of paying attention to the breathing that's happening in the belly. And then you can also feel it when you're concentrated in the belly. You can also feel it in the nostrils, in the chest, everywhere in the body. Trust that breathing. Make it your friend. It will always be there for you. If it helps, it would be good. I do this myself. Count to 10. One for each exhale. Up to 10, start again at 1. If you feel sleepy, one of the five hindrances, very common in session. It's there sometimes, can't do anything about it, then it's gone for no reason. But when you're feeling that way, you can try to put extra attention on the breath in. And also you can make sure your eyes are open and emphasize the light in the room. Make it brighter. And in those ways, try to wake yourself up. If, on the other hand, you're the opposite of sleepy, you're restless, your mind is jumping around, focus on the out-breath all the way out. Even when you're walking and eating and resting, focusing your attention on the breath and on the body is the way to practice. It will be there. As soon as you lose track and you come back, it'll be there. Our practice is a very, very simple practice. It's not at all hard to do. And the great secret is that really it's not hard to become an awakened person. You can do it for sure. And not only that, you're already doing it. Just be patient with yourself. Just keep at it. You are here on the first day of Sesshin. You are a dignified human being who has made the decision that you're going to do this. So most of the work is already accomplished. So let's just enjoy the week together and support one another in our practice. Thank you all very, very much for listening and for your practice.